Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. And today we have two guests with us. First, Mike King, and you may have already been aware of his YouTube site, Profiling Evil. If not, you need to go check it out. We'll put a link below. And also with us is Natalie Ainge, and she is one of the victims of the case that we're going to talk about with Mike here today. So let's, you know, give him a warm welcome. And Mike, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
Oh, it's great to see you again, Scott, and thank you so much. And I'm thrilled that Natalie was able to carve out a little time to come in and join us in the discussion.
Absolutely. That's great. And Natalie, thanks for being here. I appreciate you taking the time and your willingness to talk about your experience.
Yeah, of course. I got stuck in some traffic on the way back from the airport, so I literally just pulled off the freeway.
All right, well, thanks. Be safe, that's for sure. So Mike, first, tell me a little bit about Profiling Evil. Tell me about your site. Tell the viewers about your site, and then, you know, a little bio about yourself, and then we'll get into your book.
Oh, thanks, Scott. You know, we actually started in June of last year, and so we've got about 9 or 10 months under our belt now. We're growing well. We're thrilled with the wonderful response we've got from people. But I wanted to build this channel for a couple of pretty simple reasons. One is to take my investigative experience and just highlight unsolved cases, missing persons cases, unidentified body cases, and just talk about them from a perspective of an investigator and a profiler. But my secondary reason, and to me personally is equally important, is I wanted to rehumanize law enforcement in the public's eyes, because I just have felt like the last couple years law enforcement's really taken a hit on the chin. And in some cases, like in what we're experiencing today with the Chauvin trial, some of it is well-deserved criticism, but police officers across the board, my experience has been the majority really want to do that protect and serve thing. And I didn't feel like they were getting the recognition that they deserved. So we threw the channel together. We're growing, I think, really well. People seem to enjoy the content. My career, I spent 28 years doing street work. I started in patrol functions and worked my way through SWAT operations. I was lucky because in the years when Chips was popular on television, I was riding motorcycles for the police department. So I got to have the cool mirror sunglasses and the high boots. But I worked my way up through the ranks. I worked in investigations for much of my career. Eventually was promoted to chief in the Attorney General's office, where I went back and met profilers at the Bureau, and had the distinct privilege of being trained by a number of profilers in this art and science of criminal profiling. And was able to add it because I always kind of felt like we make it too much voodoo witch magic when we talk about profiling, which really to me was more just about putting some theory and some best practice to criminal investigations. Since then, I retired about 15 years ago and went to work for a global company called Esri. And I manage, I'm a global director for our emergency communications and fraud practice around the world. And we have about 140 offices around the world, and kind of the big gorilla when you think about mapping. So that's the long and short of me.
That's amazing. So obviously tell us about your book. I mean, this is, it's an interesting read, and it's interesting how, you know, the case came to you. You're just kind of on duty, right?
Yeah, it is crazy, Scott. I was actually working as a property crimes detective in the county attorney's office, and I'd been with the county attorney about 2 years. I was probably 11 or 12 years into my career as a police officer. my responsibility in the county attorney's office at the time was running undercover sting operations. And we were in the middle of an operation, and I happened to walk into the office one day just shortly after lunch, and the secretary grabbed me and she said, "Hey, can you take a moment and talk to this woman in the waiting room?" She said she's been waiting for a while and we don't have anybody available. So I was kind of the last rung on their preferred list ladder, and I went over and introduced myself to her. She's a very confident young woman, stood up, shook my hand, and said, "I've been involved in a cult that's sexually abusing children. Do you have a minute to talk to me?" And, you know, holy cow, that opened up
You didn't say, "Hold on, I'm operating a sting operation going on over here."
You can imagine this, Scott. So we walked back into the office, and there's part of you that's saying, "This person's crazy and I got to just get through this and move on to the next case." And we went back and she started to lay out the things that were happening, but she identified that it was a group, a religious cult in the northern end of our state that we had heard ghost stories about for years but could never prove anything. And of course, then all of a sudden you start to get really interested. And as she laid more and more information out, it was that battle between what's believable and what's possible. And as it unfolded, it turned into one of the most incredible investigations I've ever been a part of.
Yeah, I had a case very similar to that once where somebody walked in to the police department and said, "Hey, I want to tell you this story about how basically we've been kidnapped, held against our will, forced to have children, you know, with these people, and the child is name is under the son, but it's really the dad's involved." And the detective, who I got to know really well throughout that case, was like, "I'm listening to this story. I'm like, I don't believe this. This is absolutely crazy." Yeah. And then the more he started to look into it, it was like, "Oh my gosh, this really happens. You know, it happened." And so it just shows you that, you know, life can be stranger than fiction, you know.
Yeah, and isn't that the truth? You can't write this kind of stuff. I mean, what I thought would be just a couple of moments to ascertain whether this person was sane or not turned into about a three-hour interview. And at that point, we set up a meeting to meet the following morning again, and it was kind of getting close to the end of the business day, and I walked into the county attorney, and I said, "You're not going to believe this." Yeah. And he didn't believe it.
Well, I know. It's sometimes things are so crazy that you literally just, like, we need to have this person given a competency evaluation, right? How do I know what? Yeah. It's just so bizarre. But, you know, I always thought all those crazy things that you heard about or, you know, like on the crime shows, like, man, these writers, how do they come up with this stuff, right? And then you figure out most of those writers were attorneys, or they went and got their stories from real cases. I mean, you don't have to make this stuff up. It really happens. They literally just change the names. It's amazing. People just think, yeah, I'm crazy when I talk about stories, and they're just like, "Oh, that didn't happen." I'm like, it happened. No matter how bizarre you think it may sound.
How a group of up to about 120 people could really be under your nose and getting away with something like this. And you know, we had estranged husbands who came forward in custody battles and would complain and say, "I'm being forced to buy my son back for $10,000 to get custody of him, but I can't get access to my daughters." And, you know, law enforcement's normal response is, "It's a civil matter. Good luck and get them out the door." And, you know, Natalie can attest to why boys were not as important as girls within this group. But there were just so many people. And you think, how could you possibly have really 13 or 14 homes in a conclave with people with really bizarre behavioral things going on, and yet they slip under the radar?
Yeah. Well, so tell us, where did your investigation lead, and what did you find out about this Zion Society?
Well, I think the thing that first happened is the county attorney said, "You're no longer doing property crime. You now are a sex crimes investigator, and you're going to follow this through, and let's just chase a couple of these ghost stories and see." And the first ghost story when I was able to validate that that was accurate, it was then, let's do the next ghost story. And of course, the interviews went on with this woman who came forward, who frankly, Scott, came forward acknowledging that she too could be charged with felony crimes of assault. And she was so concerned about getting this burden off her shoulder that she was willing to accept that responsibility. And she was never charged. And of course, you know, the prosecution, I think, made the right decision. She was so important to the case.
Sure.
But as we dug in, we realized a couple of things that we immediately had to be concerned about. First was that the group was a survivalist mentality group. There were reports of semi-automatic weapons and weapons training and stockpiling of weapons in the homes. There were ghost stories that the homes were interconnected by alarm systems and that there were sentries. There was only one way in and one way out of this little community where they were living. And those sentries were posted around the clock, and they would report anytime someone came into the neighborhood that wasn't familiar to the neighborhood. There were concerns because there were neighbors reporting huge amounts of food and other kinds of commodities being moved after hours in the dark from home to home. So you had all these ghost stories going on. But the real concern was there were these allegations that the 32 children that were living there were potentially being sexually assaulted. And we could not tip our hand, even internally with police departments or others, to say we're investigating this group. We had to very clandestinely put together a case, and we had to do it quickly, knowing that children were at risk.
Yeah, so the leader, this Arvin Shreve, tell us a little bit about him and how could he get people to follow him, so to speak.
Yeah, and I want Natalie to jump in here because Natalie is a granddaughter of Arvin Shreve and knows him very well. But here is this kind of described as grandfatherly figure who people said was just incredibly sweet and kind, and he was a landscaper. In fact, he designed the landscaping around the courthouse. He was a fixture down there. Every judge, every lawyer, every cop in town knew who he was. And he was actually using that to his advantage and somehow convincing the children and others that secrecy needed to be upheld and that he would know if a police officer ever became aware of what was going on. But he started to create in his mind this idea that he could have a commune. It started early on with his belief system in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and polygamy. The church recognized how far off track he was, and when he refused to listen to priesthood leaders' counsel to stop teaching polygamy, he was eventually, like 30 years earlier, excommunicated from the Latter-day Saint faith. But it didn't stop his idea that he was a special emissary of God and that he had these special rights to bring together a group of women who would become his spiritual wives. Now, what we learned through the investigation was that he was secretly also going out and buying prostitutes and other kinds of things as he went, and we started to build a assessment on him that he was a predatory pedophile and that he was a sex addict, and all of this was built around him to justify his need or desire sexually. And then, of course, he creates this entire environment and then laces it and wraps it with a this is sanctioned by God. And seemingly intelligent people bought off on this and continued to come in droves and become members of this group.
What was his goal and mission, so to speak, that would get these people to come and follow him? You know, like, I get it, survivalist mode, but I mean, was everybody having a good, basically, good time as well?
You know, I've done a lot of study in cults, and I, after this investigation, took over the polygamy and the ritual abuse stuff for the state of Utah. And the thing that I found consistent is that it's about the leader, and they somehow convince people that they have something additional light and knowledge that no one else has. They're a special breed of people that God's going to really take good care of because they're doing these things. And they take these seemingly intelligent people and convince them to start committing crime because God's law is a higher law than man's law, and they somehow buy off on this goofiness and start to become an integral part of it. But originally, now this is a guy who had probably 30-ish wives at the time of the arrest, aging from age, get this, 2 to 64. He was having sexual relationships with all of those individuals on a regular basis. And because he was the prophet, it was weird because all the inspiration for the beautiful young new women that would join the group happened to point to, oh, you're now the prophet's wife. There were, I think, 2, Natalie, maybe 3 men that were given the right to have 1 or 2 additional wives. And Natalie could really speak to that, Scott. But that was the crux. He built it, but like in all cults, it's not like mainstream religion where we worry about picking up and lifting the downtrodden and the people who are really hurting. In a cult, it's all about lifting up the leader and making their standard in life better.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Natalie, tell me, I mean, what was your experience like? I mean, at what age were you brought into this? And did you ever think, hey, this is wrong, or this is, I'm just following what I'm being told?
Well, I was born into it because my father was Arvind Shreve's son. And my mother was college roommates with one of Arvind Shreve's wives. And after she left her first husband and her 4 kids behind to join this cult, I was born into it. Like my dad's first wife and my mom were pregnant at the same time. Like, I have a brother that's 3 weeks younger than I am. So I was there until 1991. So, you know, being born into it, I think there are a lot of times when we didn't realize that anything was wrong because it was our whole world, and we weren't allowed to watch TV. We weren't really allowed to have friends outside of the cult. We didn't go to school. And nobody really went anywhere alone, even to grocery stores and the bank and that kind of thing. Like, money was just handed over to him or whoever he decided handled finances. And so there were a lot of things that I feel we all felt we didn't enjoy or we didn't like or we didn't want, but I think most of us were very impressionable and brainwashed from a very young age.
You didn't know this wasn't normal. You thought everybody kind of went
right,
went about
right.
this.
Yeah. And there, I mean, I think one of the things that Arvind excelled at was using people, you know, I don't want to like disagree with Mike, but I wouldn't say necessarily that a lot of these adults were that intelligent, because I think he found, like a lot of these kind of megalomaniacal people do, very gullible, impressionable, damaged, broken people. I think he knew exactly who to look for, especially in women. And he could very quickly manipulate them into doing what he wanted by playing on their fears and then dangling some kind of carrot of eternal salvation and that he has some sort of truth that nobody else had. Yeah. And so I think that's very seductive to a lot of lost people, you know? So
no, absolutely. I mean, I had a case that started out where everybody thought it was some sort of cult ritual, and several children wound up deceased. And very similar in the sense that they're all kind of getting together looking for this higher purpose, You know, like, hey, if you eat the way I do, if you dress the way I do, you follow me, we're going on this journey, we're going to find this higher enlightenment and join me, be part of it so you don't miss it. And I've also seen, you see a lot of it now with a lot of the constitutional people that say, oh, you don't have any authority over me, but I found this case that I really like, so I'm going to use that, and I'm going to cite this and that. It's just nonsense. But you find it's usually people that have lost their homes in foreclosures. And so it's like kind of their way of being part of the group of saying, you know, this is, we're going to stick it to the man, so to speak.
Right.
And, you know, they find those people that have that similar hardship, so to speak, that bonds them all together, that they can really relate to. And they're like, you know, we're going to the promised land. Come with us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, that's right on, Scott, because one of the things that he focused on was he looked for women going recently divorced or going through divorces that were working hourly wage jobs, because there was a greater dependency for them to have some security in their life. And immediately they would offer them housing and food and childcare. And of course, like many cults, they surrounded them at first with love until they get them in. And then once their foot's caught in the trap, then all of the mind manipulation games start, the isolation, the rough treatment until you comply. And it didn't take long, probably less than a month for most people to just say, well, you know what, I can live on the street and try to care for my kids, or I can put up with all this weird stuff and at least have a house and a roof. And they were very good at it.
Yeah. So Natalie, what was the day like there?
It was very regimented. We had to wake up at a certain time. We had to make our bed just so, you know, it was, I don't want to say military, but every hour was full of something. I mean, down to the minute, it was yard work, schoolwork, which there was no STEM. There was hardly literature. It was, you know, I was a full reader of scripture at 18 months old, and I could do that, but I had no idea what biology was. I had no idea, you know, like, they're going into the school system at second or third grade was very difficult because there were such huge gaps in our education. But we did learn how to write very pretty cursive and to read scripture and to sew, to cook, to process foods and to save them, and to garden, because we all had like gardening, big, you know, beautiful gardens with lots of, like, I think self-sustenance was the aim generally there. Even though the aesthetics were good, you know, very nice, because he was a landscaper. But and then we cleaned a lot because everything had to be perfect. Our clothes had to be perfect. Our towels had to be hung just so. We had to be color coordinated, you know, just everything was getting us one step closer to perfection so that God would let us into heaven, kind of thing. So it was scripture study. It was, you know, and then part of our education was like a sexual education, and what we had to do as women, you know, because what we needed to do was find a husband and be the perfect wife for a husband. So there was a lot of like they would weigh us every day. Our food and calories would be very limited depending on how good we were that way. You know, there were some crazy diets, like, you know, we were kind of segregated and isolated, and especially from the boys, if there were young boys. So it was all the girls would usually be in one place and all the boys would be getting a different education. I don't know what their days were like. There weren't very many of them, you know? And then, you know, I mean, we would often be, we were taught that having a carnal relationship with your, carnal meaning not intimate as in sexually intimate, but having an attached relationship with your parents is, or with anybody, was sinful. And so we had to be sent to a bunch of different homes so that we didn't attach to anybody, especially our parents, correctly. Mm-hmm.
Part of the isolation.
And yes, yeah, and then we were isolated, and in that way, you know, we had to learn and unlearn rules very quickly. We had to deal with other people's tempers and ways of living in their homes. And usually you're living with a man who wasn't related to you. And so that comes with its own problems, you know, because possibly this guy was being groomed to be your husband later, kind of thing.
Sure.
So
Mike, where did your investigation, tell everybody how you basically were able to discover more instances of, you know, laws being broken, and how did you ultimately get him?
Yeah, so we started looking at these, and of course we had to work under the radar for fear that we might lose evidence when it came time to have the raid. And some of the stories that we learned along the way were, not only were the children being sexually assaulted inside the homes in the compound, and when I say sexually assaulted, Scott, I mean everything from aggravated rape down to simple touching. And these children were being exposed daily. When we finished, I estimated that we had at least 4,000 counts of sexual assault and rape. I know that Natalie and the other survivors said I was maybe about halfway right, that it was probably double that.
Usually is in those type of situations.
Yeah, it just continued to blossom. But what we learned along the way was that this perversion was even more deep than we understood, because not only was Shreve teaching this concept of polygamy, of one man having multiple wives, but then he came up with this goofy doctrine called the sister council, and he said that God had authorized the women to start having sexual relationships with each other, and it was actually required that they had these relationships. And so we saw his perversion starting to continue on and masticize. And then before long, evidence started showing that it was no longer good enough that he was having relationships with the women and the women were having relationships with each other. But then he had to start having relationships with the children, and the women started having relationships with the children. So now you have all of these adults who are authorized to have sexual relationships with the children. And so we thought,
and it was almost like a commandment, you know, like you had to teach this sexual way of life to the people who were in your sister council. You know, it was his commandment. It was God's commandment. It was part of your responsibility. And so I know so many people, so many of the kids who ended up growing up and being younger or older, into their teens, who have a vast amount of guilt because of what they had to teach or do with other children that were younger than them.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, forced to do that in front of adults and that kind of thing. So it was difficult. It's difficult for them because they feel like abusers, even though, I mean, you can tell somebody they're not. For
sure.
A long time.
And obviously you were born into this, but looking back now, does it not surprise you that, you know, an adult that came into this situation never questioned anything, never said this isn't right?
It's astonishing to me. Yeah, it really is. Like, I think that's the biggest lie that these people tell themselves, because when the people who are still around in our lives now claim to have a lot of innocence when it comes to what they knew was going on and what they didn't know was going on. So far as to villainize the officers who came in saying, you know, they planted these ideas in your head, they brainwashed you, they were the, you know, this didn't really happen. And I think in some cases they believe it, and in some cases they're just, you know, CYA.
Yeah.
Kind of. But I think, you know, when you get somebody who's gullible and then you take their child from them and say, you know, here's, we can give them to someone else to raise, because it takes a village. And then you can be doing the Lord's work and know that your kid is safe. I think that there are some women who did believe that, but I think there are also a lot of women, including my mother, who were very willfully blind to that sort of thing.
Do you still have contact with your mother?
No. No. I mean, I was raised by her for the rest of the time, you know, and there were things that I didn't know or didn't know what to believe. But as I got older, you know, she still won't cut ties with that sort of life. You know, she still doesn't believe what happened to me. She doesn't believe what happened to my siblings. She's still friends with one of the women there who was, if you ask anybody, probably just as or even more insidious as Arvin was. And she won't hear it. She doesn't believe that this woman did what she did, even though she spent a decade in prison.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's shocking. It's one of those things that they'll never, and I've noticed that over the years, particularly in sex cases, people come up with many, many excuses, and they'd rather go to prison for the rest of their lives than ever admit that something occurred or that it was wrongful in any way, you know, for family reasons, religious reasons, who knows why. But,
you know, thing that we still hear, I think, the most often is nobody really understands what we were trying to achieve. You know, nobody really understands the dogma behind what we were doing.
They're not enlightened enough. If they knew what was going on, they would come and join us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everyone else is a bunch of idiots, and we're the only smart ones that have cracked the code.
You know, to show how aggravating this was, Scott, the children were actually trained. The group knew that one day police would come and investigate, whether it was because of a custody battle or something else. And the children were actually trained with anatomically correct dolls. And they would, group members would dress up like police officers and interview the children with the anatomical dolls. And they were told, the children were told, these are the devil's dolls and don't ever touch them. Well, we had no idea. And it wasn't until we had this massive children in the Children's Justice Center trying to walk through and forensically examine what was happening. We couldn't figure out why all of them were repelled by the anatomically correct dolls. And it wasn't until later that we figured out, in fact, one of the group members, when I said, we can't get the children to even help us understand with a doll. And she said, oh my goodness, it worked. And it was all down to this training to keep us from being able to use those to help uncover information.
Yeah. So Mike, how long did your investigation, from the time that the woman walks in and you just kind of take the, you know, the courtesy call there at the desk, how much time from there to the end of your investigation where Mr. Shreve and his compatriots were arrested?
Well, so I immediately, after getting the county attorney's blessing, went to the largest police department in the area and asked for a number of handpicked detectives to help me in the case. We then enlisted a few other experts, and we went round the clock for about 30 days investigating this case and building enough that we could do the search warrant. We then went to the judge, and we were able to get a search warrant for 8 of the 13 homes. And we were able to get pickup orders for the children to take them into protective custody. And our primary goal was to arrest the self-proclaimed prophet Shreve and take him into custody with the idea that we would then make additional arrests. So on that morning, a month later, we at 6 o'clock in the morning kicked the doors on all of the homes. We had 70 police officers and caseworkers from family services with us, and went in just this incredible display of force to try to get control as quickly as possible. It was one of those things that has to happen that I don't know that I'll ever get over because of the trauma that it put on the children and everyone else. But knowing that there were stockpiles of weapons and all of this end of world mentality, we had to go in and get control quickly. All of those ghost stories were found to be true, by the way, Scott. Yeah. We found, you know, just everything that we were fearful we would find.
Did Arvin tell you all, you know, the big plan?
So you'll love this as a defense attorney, because he turned himself in 3 days later in southern Utah, about 300 miles away. And I was sitting in the Children's Justice Center, actually watching Natalie's sister being interviewed at the time. And I got a page on my phone, and so my pager, and I hurried and called, and they said, "We got Arvin in custody." And at the time, I was driving this little Camaro with T-tops on it that we'd taken from a dope dealer, and it became, you know, part of the old seizure days when we used to be able to get all kinds of equipment to help law enforcement.
Sure.
And another detective and I jumped in that car, and I'll tell you, we drove at breakneck speed that 300 miles, and walked in, and we sat down and asked Shreve if he would talk to us, and he immediately invoked an attorney. And of course, you know, this big deflated feeling of but we had a backup plan that we talked about on the way down, that if in fact he pled for an attorney or wanted an attorney, that we would bundle him up, put him in the car, and then we would make the drive back to northern Utah. And along the way, we would talk about religion, but we would massacre religious doctrine, knowing that it would absolutely drive him crazy that we had things so wrong.
Yeah.
And every time he would try to correct us on something, we'd turn and we'd say, "You've asked for an attorney, you can't talk to us." And then we would go on to massacre whatever was written in the Bible or LDS doctrine, and it just drove him crazy. And by the time we made it about halfway, and we decided to stop for dinner, and of course he was in shackles in his wrists and ankles, and I took those off, and I said, "Arvin, I'll take these off, but I said, you need to understand that you're a felon, and if you try to run, there's a really big penalty for fleeing felons." And so we went in and we sat down in this little truck stop restaurant in the center of Utah, in this no town place. And as we sat down, the waitress came up and I said, "Put it on one ticket, anything that my buddy and my dad want." And I don't know why, because just kind of a smart aleck comment. And I pointed at Arvin and said, "My dad." And I looked over and he had a tear running down his eye. And we ate dinner, and he said at the end of the dinner, he said, "I have never been treated so kindly in all of my life." He said, "I really want to tell you what happened." And I said, "I really want to hear it, but I can't talk to you." And so we got in the car and started driving a little further, and we kind of cranked up the bad philosophy discussion. Finally got to the point he just couldn't stand it, and he said, "Give me a phone. I want to call my attorney and cancel my attorney. I'll go on record. I don't want an attorney. I want to tell you guys what happened." And so we spent the next hour trying to reach his attorney, and we truly called his attorney at home. We called his office. We sent patrol officers by the attorney's house. And he said, "I got to get this off my chest." And so we pulled into a highway patrol substation.
Sure.
And this poor highway patrol sergeant was standing there. We said, "Come with us." We re-Mirandized him, and we said, "Now, Arvin, you don't want an attorney, even though you've invoked one." And we said, "Now, we're going to leave the room, and we want this patrol sergeant to talk to you and try to talk you out of this." And so we had this great conversation recorded of him saying, "I no longer want my attorney," and at that point he opened the floodgates and gave us count after count after count, I think to 32 counts of sexual assault and rape.
What made him tick? I mean, what was his motivating factor? Was, like you said, it was the, you know, the sex addict, and this is just his way? And I mean, did it just kind of happen? just kind of grew into something bigger, and you know, and he couldn't stop it, but figured, what the hell, let's just go with it? Or did he have some other evil, you know, motive that was going on?
I'm going to let Natalie maybe answer that, but I'm going to preface it with this. The investigation showed that he actually confessed to having tendencies of watching young girls at the high school football games, fantasizing about girls, turning to look up their skirts as he sat on the stands. He then let it be known that he had I had actually found four prostitutes that he had frequented. And of course, we used that as one of the interrogation techniques because he kept saying, no, I would never do anything. And finally, I just slid their pictures across the table and said, here's what Melanie said. Here's what this one said. And so once he started realizing that the house of cards was collapsing around him, then he started to say, well, here's why I did it. And of course, for him, the reason why was because I was commanded of God. And I remember him saying, I even told my wife, I don't want to do this, but I don't want to offend God. Baloney, Scott. He started in this predatory behavior, and he built this kingdom around him in order to continue his pedophilia.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Natalie, please.
And he had an excuse for everything.
Well, I think he was a true believer at first in the LDS faith, and then later in his own relationship that he feels like he had with the divine, you know, God. And I think he scoured every inch of dogma he could possibly get from the inception of the LDS church to the present day of the time, because to figure out a way to excuse his behavior and his predilections with scripture, and then figure out a way how to use that to create the perfect environment for him, because he liked the power. I think he liked being the one that the knowledge flowed through, you know, and he wanted what he wanted. And if he could find, I mean, I remember binders and binders and binders of doctrine from like LDS doctrine all the way back to when they practiced polygamy, you know, and he would be very, upset with the church about how they would cave to the government when, you know, the government, they only stopped polygamy because the government told them they had to. They only allowed black people into the church because the government said that they couldn't discriminate anymore. And so that upset him, that that's where he thought that the leaders of the LDS faith went off the rails and started listening to men instead of God. And so he truly believed, I think, that he wanted to kind of harken back to an earlier time when prophets were prophets and they had this iron fist control over their, you know, he believed he was one of them. I think he lied to himself just as much as he lied to anybody else, because he was that desperate to excuse his terrible behavior and what, you know, and his perversion.
Yeah. So Natalie, I mean, obviously this was when you were much younger, but you know, we kind of talked about this last night in our live, is what are you supposed to think when the truth turns out to be a lie? How'd that affect you? You know, growing up, trusting people, you know, your religion, your faith in religion. How's that affected you?
I don't know. I think I'm an incredibly cynical person. I have a hard time trusting anybody's anything at face value.
You should become a police officer or a criminal defense attorney.
Tell them the truth.
You've met the qualifications. Usually it takes years.
I worked, I worked for the Utah County Sheriff for 11 years.
Okay.
So I did evidence collection for the Officer Involved Shooting Task Force. I worked on the White Collar Crime Task Force. And then I worked in the I started off like working in the medical division of the jail. And so I think that also sometimes colored my vision of other people too, you know, because I feel like, you know, I saw a lot of stuff there as well. But I think it soured me for sure on believing anybody who like claims to have arbitrary knowledge without any kind of empirical data to back it up, kind of thing, you know.
Prove it to me.
Like, right.
Trust so, but verify.
Right. Right. Or just verify. Like, I can say,
prove it.
I like you as a human. I don't think you're lying, but also, like, you're full of shit until you tell me, like, until you prove otherwise, basically, you know? Yeah, well. And this, I think that's hindered me somewhat, but it also is a way to keep us safe, you know, because I still see how it can go the other way, because I have siblings and I see people who are still very susceptible to brainwashing and still very susceptible to religious guilt and shame and letting men have certain like authority over them, you know, and that kind of thing. Like there is, I think it could be a lot worse.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, good. I'm glad, you know, for lack of a better term, you turned out to be normal and self, you know, well-adjusted.
Whatever normal is.
But it's good to have that certain level of skepticism. And, you know, I look back thinking I was so naive, you know, when I was in my probably 20s. And, you know, there's black and there's white. You know, there's the line, right, wrong, truth, good, you know. And then as you get older, you're like, well, maybe it's a little in between. And then you start realizing all these people that say they're good are not always good, you know? I mean,
right.
And so it's, like I said, you should become a police detective or a criminal defense attorney just because you become very skeptical and cynical of lots of things
right.
where it's like, okay, prove it. You say they're going to say this, bring them into, I want to hear it, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I see it in writing.
When everybody came in and the police raided and took everybody into protective services, what was that like? I mean, can you even describe that?
Natalie, I had left.
Oh, you left at that point. Okay.
My mother's first husband was an LAPD officer. Who by that time was becoming pretty high ranking, if I remember correctly. And I think they began to see the writing on the wall because we left just a couple of months before the raid happened.
Okay. So,
and it was very much like, I was told your father's not your father. You can't ever talk about this. You can't tell anybody where you're from. You don't know the name Shreve. Like my mom told me that, you know, the guy who's been acting as your father for the last 8 years, 7 years is, was just there and he was my husband, but like your dad's name was Dave, some guy I met in college. And so just forget everything that happened up until now, kind of thing. So, and that was it. Like I was not allowed to talk about it to her, to anybody else.
Do you have communications with anybody these days that was there with you?
Yeah, mostly because of Mike. I mean, I've stayed in contact with my siblings, for sure, to various degrees. And once Mike contacted my oldest sister, Dawn, we got in contact, and then we've become closer to some of the other people that we hadn't seen in 25 years. So, I mean, that's one thing we're grateful to Mike about, you know, kind of bringing us back together. Because it's, well, like you said, in the beginning, like, in the beginning, Yeah. You mentioned that, like, you know, the truth is often stranger than fiction. And like, that's been our experience. I think that's the most difficult. I've been to therapy sessions where I've had therapists accuse me of being having delusions, you know, or being grandiose or blowing things out of proportion or whatever. You know, and even when I tell my husband stuff, or it is just kind of unbelievable. It is just kind of like, okay, like no one knows really what to do with that. And no one was there for the little things. Like, there's sexual things, you know, but like, we can get together and talk about like those days where we were forced to sit on the couch for hours at a time because we had to learn how to be reverent. And like, I'm a fidgety human. And so like, I had days where like, I would sit on the couch for 5 hours and I'd end up like peeing on myself because I couldn't leave. I couldn't move. I couldn't drink. I couldn't, you know. Or when Waco happened, we paid very close attention to Waco. And it wasn't because we were upset about what was happening to them. You know what I mean? Like, people were kind of it felt like they were learning from those mistakes, you know, and we started becoming afraid of, you know, is a war coming? Because that was something we talked about, is like, eventually there's going to be this World War III, the governments are going to fall apart, everything's going to happen, and like, someday you're going to have to fight for God and like that, and maybe die for that. So there's stuff like that that's like, that sticks with you, I think, too, that you don't get asked about very often because it's not the sexy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, but it still paints who you are as a human.
Yeah, all that stuff definitely forms who you are today. Adversity forms who you are today, and you know, you've obviously persevered. That's great. So how did Mike get you all together with your siblings?
Just on Zoom. He started writing this book, I guess, and he's just reaching out to see if anybody wanted to talk to him. And I was really sad sometimes that some people wouldn't, because there are people that I'd love to see again or talk to again that I was friends with as a young child, and they're some of my only good memories. But we just all kind of had a Zoom call to talk about things so that he could do research for his book. And we just have kept in touch since then. So
it was really remarkable, Scott, because about 2 years earlier, I'd received an email from independently two of the survivors of this case asking me for help in understanding a lot of the emotion they were feeling. I didn't want anything to do with it, and I didn't want to deal with it. And I very kindly told both of them, good luck in your futures, and I just have nothing to offer. But, you know, I still had that box of evidence up on the shelf in my downstairs basement that had sat there for 30 years, and periodically I would peek in it and look at the case. But I couldn't get over the guilt that I felt by telling them no. And then the Victims' Rights Council called and asked if we would discuss on the 30th anniversary the case and where the children ended up and how they ended up. And I couldn't get these kids out of my mind. And so we started reaching out and we brought them together. And this was the first time that many of them had seen each other in 30 years. And they were giggling, they were squealing, there was some of the toughest Navy cursing I've ever heard going on. It was remarkable. And there were tears flowing like crazy. At one point, we went through the search warrant video, and for some, when they saw certain rooms from the search warrant, they completely lost it. It was so gut-wrenchingly painful.
Yeah.
And along the way, we learned how the state had really failed these beautiful children in a number of ways that we never would have imagined. Number one, we thought that we ordered state counseling, and back then was the early days of the children's justice system, and it was the early days of victims' reparations. We had court-ordered testimony, and yet the courts returned the children to the very parents that were allowing them to be abused, and the counseling never occurred.
Yeah.
We had children who couldn't get past the third grade. One in particular who became a pretty popular stripper in Los Angeles and in Albuquerque, and actually does stand-up comedy, but could never get past the third grade. She actually paid another stripper to use her identification and get a GED, which she proudly shows her GED, but they weren't able to move because all they knew were scriptures. They didn't know anything else. And so it was so compelling that we came back and went to work on how do we somehow fix this. And maybe you could talk about, Natalie, just those two areas, education and counseling, what happened in that meeting with everyone.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was great to see because, you know, some of us, I think, that were younger, we got out early enough to at least integrate into the public school system, not without some folly. But some of the older women, I mean, had not, you know, still were essentially not functioning, you know. So he got us in contact with Weber State University and with resources there to get not only high school level diplomas but even further on, or trade schooling, or and then got us in contact with the victim witness coordinators for the county there, the state there, and I think there's still quite a few people, me included, who haven't really taken advantage of therapy like we should or might have done. And a lot of people who just can't afford it. I mean, you know, mental health care can be really expensive. So, and that was, you know, for a big part of my life, especially when I was raising kids and stuff, it was definitely on the back burner when it comes to, you know, or not covered by insurance. He gave us resources to payment and to help us really get the help that is needed.
Yeah.
Sorely needed, you know.
That's good. Yeah, things have come a long way. And so, Mike, what was what happened to Arvin?
Well, we ended up arresting 12 people. It took about 2 years to get through that portion. And I'd love your opinion on a couple of these things, Scott. But it was terribly difficult for the defense attorneys because Arvin instructed the rest of the members that we had cases on to plead guilty. Now, I don't know if that was because, you know, he didn't want to go down alone or he was thinking that might stop things. But all 12 were convicted, and many of those against the advice of their counsel because their leader, their prophet, had told them to go forward and plea. Arvin eventually died in prison, and it was interesting because shortly after he died, one of the victims wrote me a letter and said, I have lived in absolute fear that he would get out of jail at some point and come and get me for testifying. She was 6 years old at the time that the raid happened.
I know he got a 20-year sentence, which, you know, you think 20 years is a, you know, it's a long time, 20 years. But that seems like a very short sentence for the number of, you know, children that he was inappropriate with over the years on a repeated basis. You know, I mean, the laws here in Colorado, you do it once, you're indeterminate life sentence, which means some bureaucrat will decide when you're safe to get out, you know, which is usually never. And I know laws have changed significantly. I've had cases where like, wow, they used to just give people probation for that, you know. But yeah, so a 20-year sentence is, I mean, seems very light.
Working in law enforcement where I work, just at a county jail, I have seen in Utah and Utah County, you know, people with 20 counts of sodomy and a boy get 18 months of work release when someone else with a selling marijuana charge will get 5 years. Like it's so arbitrary there. And I tried very, very hard when I grew up a little bit and I was 16, 17, 18 to go back and try to find some of my abusers and press charges, and I couldn't because there was like a 7-year statute of limitations on that, when there was still witnesses around and documents and evidence that I'm sure could have been helpful. Like the fact that there is a statute of limitations on rape is just like really intensely befuddling to me.
There were a number of real challenges. Number one, Scott, he was sentenced on a 20 to life minimum mandatory. So he wasn't going anywhere. That was the benefit of it was knowing that he had multiple counts and they were minimum mandatories. What we did is we also realized, and it took years to accomplish this, but we realized how punishing the criminal justice system was for children who were forced to testify in preliminary hearings and just be eaten alive and then refuse to testify once it got to hearing. And those laws have changed now to where those children's testimony can be entered without having to have the child go through that. We saw that those issues with statutes of limitation now have evolved and broadened so that a victim of sexual abuse as a child can actually file later than that statute. So
many states have changed, expanded those.
But boy, it was a terrible system back then.
I had a guy once when I got him, he was on his third sexual assault and I'm trying to figure out what his first two were. And he literally got probation. It was like, don't do it again. He would have been in the early 80s, I guess, those cases, and just befuddled, that he got such a slap on the wrist. But I think it was one of those things that people just didn't want to talk about, If we don't talk about it, it didn't happen. And if it didn't happen, well, it just didn't happen and we don't have to talk about it,
Well, and it looks bad, if it's happening in your city, it looks bad that it had been happening so long. I mean, nothing against the Ogden Police Department. They did a fabulous job with the resources they had. But I've been in those meetings with our local district attorney that I worked for, the investigations department at our county attorney's office, saying how do we deal with the PR situation of this has been going down for 10 years and we didn't know about it. So I think sometimes that's a thing. I think sometimes it's just, crimes against women have been a little less important, and I think that is changing, especially recently. So
no, I think it is. I think it is changing. There's, we've seen lots of people in position of power that have been prosecuted or, lose their career when, it's clear that they're pigs and, they need to go. I'm not going to get into it, but there's a guy in New York that, why is he still there? But
bothers me every day.
But he's a pig, but he's a politician, so I guess he gets a pass because he's a political pig.
With a family dynasty, which is a whole nother.
Which
that's another podcast.
Well, as we talked about last night, there's kind of a two-tier system, unfortunately. But it takes time, and. The police departments, I don't think they went around ignoring anything. I don't think they do that. They just, there's only so many hours in a day and there's only so many resources that they can devote to it.
Right. It's funny. They were dealing with a man who made it his position to know what those limitations were and to really fly under the radar and, like you said, he was like the Edmund Kemper of sex abusers or whatever,
But he wasn't causing any trouble out in town. He wasn't, oh, it's just a divorce case. Yeah, they're saying the Butte kids are being,
Right.
He wasn't doing anything, but at least somebody had the courage to come forward and do it. And, fortunately, Mike had the courage to say, hey, I got to look into this a little further and not just dismiss it as, oh, you're some crazy lunatic. Let me take your report and file it away. And, hats off to Mike. I mean, he probably changed for the better, most of those people.
We talk about that all of the time. Where would we have ended up? My siblings and I were pretty young. We hadn't been married to anybody yet. And even though other things had happened to us sexually, we weren't completely indoctrinated, most of us have been able to kind of integrate back into society a little bit better than a lot of other people would. And we talk about it all the time. If Mike hadn't come when he did, and if where would we be now? Like, where would, what would life be like? It would be a nightmare.
Yeah. So Mike, where can everyone get your book? How do they go about getting it?
Thanks, Scott. Profilingevil.com. If you go there, you'll be able to get it. In a couple of weeks, you'll be able to get it on Amazon. But the easiest place is there. It'll direct you over to Amazon if it's a paperback you want. But if you want the hardbound, profilingevil.com. And, you know, something that I haven't been sharing publicly, but I was counseled that I should, Scott, is I've been really blessed with, I have a career and I'm doing well. The proceeds from this book are going to the Children's Justice Center and to other kinds of events that deal with child sexual abuse. And this was such an honor for me to be able to tell these kids' stories. And I keep calling them kids. I mean, you see these beautiful adult women now. I would have never reached out had they not called a couple of years ago and said help. And it is a shame that I didn't, because they needed to come together and have each other to validate long before last year.
Yeah, well, that's great. Natalie, I hope things continue to go well for you. Mike, I hope, wish you well with your channel, Profiling Evil. We'll put a link to it. Read the book. It's a very good read. It's straightforward. You'll get enthralled. And even better, the proceeds go to charity, to, you know, the Children's Justice Center. So you're not just reading a good book. You're putting money back into the community to help kids. Who can go wrong with that? You can't.
Yeah. And, you know, Scott, before we leave, I want to just make mention, and I don't know if she'll allow me to do this, but Natalie actually was able to leverage all of these things that she learned as a child and turned into an incredible author herself. In fact, a very well-known author by a name other than Natalie Ainge. And Natalie, I think you should probably just come out of anonymity if you want.
Okay. feel free to plug your book. I mean, you know, okay. Nothing. Little selfless shame promotion is good. All right.
I write for Macmillan and St. Martin's Press as Kerrigan Byrne. I write mostly historical romantic fiction and some historical crime fiction under the same name. It's Byrne, Irish spelling B-Y-R-N-E. Right now I'm working on The Business of Blood and A Treacherous Trade, which are Fiona Mahoney mysteries. She does the job that I used to do, which is cleaning up after crime scenes when the officers leave, and bagging and tagging evidence and getting rid of the blood. So she usually finds her own evidence and gets involved. So,
all right. Well,
kind of
great.
Amateur, yeah.
Congratulations. I'm glad that's going well. And I wouldn't have known that, Mike. Thanks for letting us know.
Oh, you gotta look her up. I mean, her covers are those incredibly steamy, beautiful books. I just think it's so fun what she's been able to do. And I'm so proud of her and the other survivors, because that's the real message from my standpoint, Scott, is they beat them in the end. And they are the victors.
The truth always comes out. May take a little time. But the truth comes out. So I'm
well,
glad you made it,
Natalie. Guys. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Well, thank you. And thank you, Mike.
Thanks.
Great interview. Great book. Everyone, Profiling Evil, go subscribe to his page. Make sure you come back to mine, but go subscribe to his page. All right. And we look forward to talking to you again. All right.
For the few that aren't already subscribed to your page, Scott, we keep chatting you up, so thanks for everything you've done. You've been such a good friend, and I really appreciate it. And well, Natalie, I just love you and the girls, and I just am so proud of you.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys so much.
All right. Have a
great
day.
Weekend. You too.